All right, everybody, let's have an AA meeting. My name is Julie, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the Napa Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeaker.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them, too. I must have this thing. Tonight I have a real privilege to introduce our speakers. This woman has been very instrumental in my own sobriety, been my sponsor for several years, 5 years I think now, six maybe. And I've learned so much from her, and she has such a wonderful message, is such a serene person and a kind person. I'm looking forward to hearing her story because I never have. So I give you Tammy J.
Hey, everybody. My name is Tammy. I'm an alcoholic. So what I'm supposed to tell you is what it was like before, what happened, and what it's like now, and to share with you my experience, strength, and hope. So I'll start with, I'm 56 years old. That means I was born in 1958. I was born in Jamestown, New York. That's why I have this funny accent. One of three children. I was the middle child. Born in a, I guess you'd say, working class, blue-collar family. My father was a exterminator. He did that his whole life, pretty much. My mother was a housewife until I was maybe around 7 or 8 years old. And she decided she wanted to pursue a career in singing at that point and started singing in a nightclub in the evenings. And that kind of shaped me in a lot of ways because I used to sit and watch my mother get ready to go out at night. And I'd have to say she's kind of narcissistic. And she would, be trying on all these beautiful dresses, you know, with all the cleavage and everything. And, you know, and how do I look, you know, and putting on her makeup to get ready to go out and sing at night. And I would just be sitting there watching her. And I always wanted to be pretty like her. She was a very beautiful woman. She had long blonde hair and a really nice figure, and I never quite measured up. When I was in seventh grade, I remember people would say, "Is that your sister?" You know, she was like 20 years older than me, and she used to wear real short mini skirts, and you know, she was just you know, a beautiful woman. So, you know, I guess I share that because I always felt like I didn't quite measure up, that I was lacking in a lot of ways as a teenager, particularly when I started going through, adolescence and all that kind of thing that happens to us. But I'll backtrack a little bit and say that I feel like I had a fairly happy childhood up until the time I was about 11. And at that point, my parents separated. And it was really a shock because they never fought, you know, and I thought that they really loved each other. I thought that they were made for each other. My dad was kind of tall and handsome, and you know, she was blonde, and they just seemed like they were just made for each other, never fought. And then just one day my dad came home and said that he had to go away for a while. Basically, he said that he was sick and had to go away for a while. And it really crushed me because I was very attached to my father. He was the only real religious influence in my life. He was Catholic. We were brought up Catholic. And he used to take us to church. My mom didn't really like to go to church, so he would take us to church every Sunday. And I used to watch him, like at Easter when we would go to church. He just seemed really devout, you know, and I would admire that about him. And when he left, you know, when I look back at my relationship with God, I thought I had a pretty good relationship with God. But when he left, it was almost like when he left, God left. I felt that way. I felt like God left. I prayed. I would pray every single night and ask God, you know, to bring my dad back home, especially when they were separated. And my prayer was not answered. And so I feel like in a lot of ways I got really angry at God when I was about 11 or 12 years old, and I just kind of pushed God out of my life and decided, you know what, screw this God thing. Didn't ever say this exactly, but I think in my mind it was like, screw this God thing. I'm going to do whatever I want to do. I'm just going to do my own thing, and I'm not going to rely on God because God lets me down. My mother, we lived with my mother, and my mother kind of just decided, you know, she was going to do her thing now because she's single, and, you know, and she was kind of a little bit wild. She used to party a lot, and as I became a teenager, you know, she would smoke pot with us and, you know, things like that. And so I didn't really have much parental guidance growing up. I had a lot of freedom. When I was about, I guess, 12 or 13 years old, I drank for the first time. And it was one of these things where I was with my girlfriends, and we were having like a little, we used to get together when I was in junior high, and we would just make little meals, like we'd have tacos. We'd decide, oh, we're going to have tacos, and we would just go to one of the little girlfriends' houses, and we would make tacos. And one night we decided we were all going to get a little bit of booze from everybody's house. And we filled up this big bottle, this big Pepsi bottle, you know, one of the, like a half gallon, I don't know if it was a half gallon or what it was, but we filled it up with God knows what, you know. It was just, you know, vermouth from here and Southern Comfort from there and, you know, whatever we could get our hands on, and we filled that bottle up and we all drank it. And everybody got just totally drunk out of their minds, but I was very alert, you know, and as to what was going on, you know. I remember my best friend Sylvia, she got so drunk, and we all had to kind of try to get her sobered up to bring her home. And we brought her home, and her father, he was Italian, he knew she was drunk, and he slapped her from one bed to the other. She had two beds in her room, and she went from one bed to the other, to the other, to the other. And I remember thinking, I wish that I had somebody in my life who cared about me that much. You know? Because I really didn't have that. And I, in some ways, I wish I would have had somebody who would have cared enough to smack me around after I drank the first time and got drunk. But I didn't. So I just kept on. And so, you know, from the time I was about 13 to the time I wasn't even legal drinking age. You know, I had pretty much done everything that you could probably do. You know, I had done, drank a lot, you know, every time I went anywhere. I don't know if I ever went anywhere, social event. We used to have dances every weekend. That was the big thing, you know, all these garage bands in the 70s. And they would have dances at the schools, you know, junior high school, high school. I was Catholic, so we had the Catholic Youth Organization, the CYO. They used to have dances every weekend. You know, sometimes I think back, because I used to go to all those dances drunk, and I think back and I think, well, where were the priests? You know? You know, it's like, why didn't they ever say anything to me? They must have known I was drunk. You know, I used to be one of the ones that would sit along the edge of the big gym. We'd have the gym, you know, and they'd have all the chairs along all the edges, and I'd sit over there, and if I was lucky, I'd have a guy that I was making out with, you know, back over there somewhere. And or I'd be on the floor, and I would be just dancing like a absolute maniac. You know, I don't know what would come over me when I would get some alcohol in me. I mean, I would just be a total maniac. So, you know, I know this is AA, and I'm not going to get into my other addictions in great detail, but I have to say that the alcohol, when I got a little older in high school, really led to a lot of other things. And pot was a big one for me, and hallucinogenic type drugs, as well as speed. They were big, and speed was big because I could take a hit of speed and I could drink all night and not get drunk, really. I mean, at least not think I was drunk, you know, just, you could just drink and drink and drink and drink and still be awake, you know. Quaaludes were not so great. Bouncing off walls. But anyway, this went on until I was 18 years old. And I just want to say that, you know, when it comes to step one in admitting that I'm powerless over alcohol, I realize that we all have a certain place inside of us, and I have a place inside of me that was that place of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, you know, that place of having that hole, you know, inside that was so deep and so lonely. And mine might, and whatever the circumstances were that took me there may not be the same circumstances that took you there. But I got there, and let's just say that, I did a lot of things that I was not proud of. You know, I slept with people I didn't know. I stole. I cheated. You know, those kind of things that I'm not proud of. It took me a little while to get into the room of AA, and I got here in a kind of strange way, and I'll share that with you, a little bit about that with you. But I had gotten married when I was 19 years old, and believe it or not, I'm still with him. 37 years later, we're still together. We've been through our ups and downs, believe me, but we're still together. And, you know, sometimes I think in a lot of ways that God was really looking out for me. Even though I had pushed him away, he put me with a guy who was, first of all, really tolerant of a person like me who can be kind of hard to live with sometimes. But also, He wasn't really into drinking when I met him. He drank some, but he didn't drink that much. He was into pot smoking. And I, at that point in time, I was pretty much going to bars by myself and getting drunk almost every night. And I met him and started hanging out with him. And, you know, I see my addictive nature, you know, because I immediately, like, just grabbed onto him, like, you know, I mean, we were just like, we're inseparable, you know. We were just like, people used to call us the pretzels because we would be, you know, wherever we were, you know, we would be all, like, wrapped up, you know, in each other. You know, he didn't like to go out drinking. And so I really feel like getting on the marijuana maintenance program kind of saved my life for a while. And, you know, I did that for quite a while. I was a daily pot smoker. And then every now and then couldn't stand it any longer. And I would make him take me out. We'd go to a bar, and I would get just blitzed out of my mind and then, you know, make an absolute jerk of myself. And then he'd bring me home, and I'd be okay for a while, you know. So, you know, I guess I could say maybe I was a periodic drinker, binge drinker. I don't know what you want to call me, but that's kind of what I was, what I had become anyway at that point in time. And something else started happening with me, and started getting this eating disorder. And I know once again, I'm just one of these people. It's like my addiction is like this big giant wall of water, you know, and I have this dam trying to hold it all back. And, you know, I plug up the alcohol and the drugs come out of here. And if I plug up this, something else comes out. And it was just kind of like that with me, you know. And so I got this eating disorder and I ended up in Overeaters Anonymous. And that was my first 12-step program. And so, you know, here I am there, and they have the same 12 steps. Believe it or not, at that time, this was, this was in 1981. They had, our textbook was the Alcoholics Anonymous textbook. And we used to have AA speakers come and talk at our meetings. And it was like, you know, and I'd listen, and I'd be like, well, that's not me. You know, I don't have that problem. I kind of looked at my history. I looked at step one, and I realized, you know, that I had been pretty out of control in that department. And I decided, okay, well, I'm just going to use this program to help me stop doing this stuff, you know. And I stopped for a while. And, you know, I was working that program and working the steps in that program. And a little while later, we moved, my husband and I moved south. We moved to Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and he was going to go to college there. And well, he did go to college there. And I just started, all these insecurities started popping up, you know, new place, new people, and I was just feeling so uncomfortable, you know, new job, everything. I started thinking, well, you know, I can just drink, you know, maybe just when we go out on the weekends. So I'm thinking about this, you know, idea of controlled drinking. And I tried that, and it wasn't long before, I don't even know how this happened, but you remember those, I don't know, maybe they still sell them. I don't know, because I forgot to tell you what my sobriety date was. My sobriety date is February 4th, 1994. So I just celebrated 21 years. But back then, they had these big boxes of wine with a little spout in the middle. And you could just put it in your fridge and just turn on the spout and put your glass underneath. Well, I went from saying, okay, I'm only going to have a drink when I go out, to having this big thing in my fridge, you know, and saying, how did that happen? You know, I mean, just one day looking at it and saying, how did that happen? Because I was only going to be drinking on the weekends when we go out. And because I had already been in a 12, I was already in a 12-step program. I started thinking, you know, maybe I really do have a problem with alcohol. And I'm trying to remember the order, but anyway, I quit again, and then I remember I got invited to a wedding, and I got really drunk at this wedding. And basically, that was, and then I quit drinking again. I didn't drink for 3 months. And then one night I was driving around like a crazy person, feeling like I wanted to get drunk. And I ended up looking up an AA meeting, and I went to AA. And that was in 1985. 1986. But if you do the math, and I just told you my sobriety date was 1994, you realize that I didn't stay sober. It was just kind of a series of years of just trying to really let step one simmer down, you know, settle down to the core of my being. You know, they talk about we admitted to our innermost selves that we were powerless over alcohol. And I think it took me a while to really admit to my innermost self that I was powerless. Probably the biggest thing I can remember was I had gotten sober again. I was sober for 6 years, slipped and slided for a couple years, got sober again in 94, and then about 3 or 4 years later, I remember I was in a meeting, and there was this older kind of militant lady there, and she was like really old school, hardcore AA, and I was kind of complaining and saying, you know, I feel like I want to drink, and she looked at me and she said, "Will you just go and drink?" You know, I mean, she was just so tired of hearing me say that, you know. And she said, "Just go, get drunk," you know. And I thank her for saying that, because I went home that day and I sat in my chair and I started thinking about it. My husband was out of town, and at that point in time, he was drinking. And I started thinking about it, and I knew there was wine in the cabinet. And I thought, well, I guess I could. I could go get that bottle of wine, and I could open it up. And for the first time ever, the thought hit me that it wasn't really that bottle of wine that I wanted. You know, I mean, I did. But I knew that if I drank that bottle of wine, that wasn't going to do it for me. Because what I wanted was oblivion. I didn't want to feel. I didn't want to face life on life's terms. And that's kind of how I always was. You know, I was so full of fear and so full of depression, darkness, anger. I mean, I was just this big, negative, fearful person that didn't want to face life and live life on life's terms like normal people do. You know, it was hard. It was painful. And just that realization was like that. I feel like even though I had been in AA for quite a while, that was really my that I finally had taken step one on that deep eternal internal level that they talk about, that we need to do. And that was probably around 97, maybe. And since then, I feel like I have just grown by leaps and bounds as far as my spirituality and my just my life. Like, I had been in a lot of darkness, a lot of depression. Now, I have to say that the depression, for me, is a clinical thing, and I do need to have some medication for that because I do have a chemical disorder imbalance. But I have to say that between that surrender and between getting on the right medication, it has really helped me with my recovery and with looking at, you know, having a relationship with my higher power. So I want to talk about step two. Where are we? Okay. All right, we got a little time. All right, so I'm going to go into step two and talk about my higher power. Like I said, I had pushed God out of my life. When I came in here, it was kind of hard for me to see God on the board and to realize I was going to have to address that. And I remember somebody telling me, take what you like and leave the rest. And that was really very helpful for me because it made me realize I don't have to swallow all this whole thing at one in one bite. You know, I can look at it and I can take it as it comes. For me, I did have to get to a point where I found a higher power that worked for me. I'm not a practicing Catholic anymore. I don't go to the Catholic Church. But I don't have the negative feelings that I once had towards the Catholic Church. I was very resentful of the church, and they were on my first inventory. It's just nice to be able to talk about the Catholic Church now and not have the feelings that I once had, you know, about the priests and about Monsignor Calagioia, who used to yell at me when I went to confession, stuff like that. But but anyway, today my higher power is a loving God, a God who wants for me my fullest potential, a God who gives me the courage and the strength to face life on life's terms, to be able to just put one foot in front of the other and do the next right thing, to go to work, to be a responsible, mature human being. I couldn't do those things without my higher power. And I found my higher power here in AA. So the two things work together for me in a lot of ways. Step three, making a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand Him. I think, you know, in regards to alcohol and other mind and mood altering substances and addictions, I think that, you know, I've taken that step on a day-to-day basis. I still struggle with, you know, some things, but for the most part, the things that are going to kill me are turned over to my higher power and to His care, His or her, it, whatever. But on a daily basis, I have to say, you know, and sometimes several times a day, Thy will be done, not mine. Because I know, you know, what my will is, you know. In a lot of ways, I say I'm powerless over alcohol, and I am, but I think I'm powerless over me. I'm powerless over me, myself. And so every day is a battle. Well, it's not so much a battle anymore, but every day is a choice. Am I going to do it my way, or am I going to do it my higher power's way? And higher power's way is always the better way. Step four, my first inventory was, it was kind of a blaming inventory. You know, I did a lot of, well, you know, I wouldn't have felt this way if so-and-so hadn't have done this to me, you know. And a lot of it was my mother and my father, mostly my mother in the divorce, and, you know, not having the parental guidance that I should have had, you know. Kids should have that, I think. you know. And, you know, blaming the church. There was a lot of blame. And my first sponsor, I don't know, she never really pointed that out to me, and I don't know if it was really her job to do that, but when I came around to do another inventory, I realized that the first one had been mostly about blame, and that really the inventory isn't so much about blame and looking at what other people have done to me. You know, it's more about looking at seeing myself clearly. You know, seeing my assets, my liabilities, and, you know, seeing what I can do to accentuate the assets and let go of some of those liabilities. And, of course, a lot of those liabilities get let go of in steps 6 and 7. So I'll kind of move over there a little bit and talk about that, you know. And I think steps 6 and 7 to me are, they're just something that I'm going to be doing the rest of my life. You know, and it says that in the 12 and 12, it says that this is a lifetime job. And it is, you know. I've got a lot of stuff, a lot of my own stuff. I don't need to worry about anybody else's stuff because I just need to try to keep my side of the road clean, keep those character defects that pop up and that really eat my lunch from time to time. Those are the things that, you know, I have to let go of and give to my higher power to take and heal, or whatever, you know, whatever you think it is. I think in a lot of ways it is a healing. It's a cleansing, I don't know. But so I'm kind of there. I won't talk a whole lot more about 6 and 7 right now. 8, the first step 8 I did was very terrifying because, or 9 is when you actually make the amends. 8 is when you figure out what those amends are that you got to make. I was more scared of the financial amends, the things that I had stolen, and how am I going to make that right, than I was of the kind of life kind of amends, like things that I, you know, did to my husband, you know, things, those kind of amends, you know, that are not quite as tangible as like when you actually steal something from somebody. And it's kind of interesting because when I made those monetary amends, you know, looking back now, those were so easy compared to the life amends, you know, the people that you hurt and, you know, the people in your life, that you live with on a day-to-day basis, you know. Those are the hardest amends, I think, to make. I think for the most part, my relationship with my husband today is a good relationship. We've had a lot of ups and downs, but today it's a pretty good relationship. And he knows when to he knows when I need a meeting. He'll tell me, you know, say, have you been, you need a meeting? And he's not in the program, but he knows a lot about the program. And he doesn't drink today, and that's real helpful for me. He just decided that it was more healthy for him not to drink, so he doesn't drink. 10, 11, and 12, those are kind of what we call the maintenance steps, you know. So I live in those steps. When I make a mistake, I try to correct it. I try to stay in constant contact as well. Constant, that's kind of hard. But I try to stay in contact with my higher power on a daily basis. And I've done this thing for years, this quiet time thing in the morning. And my very first sponsor taught me that. I get up in the morning and I I read something from one of the little books, you know, maybe the 24 Hours a Day book or one of the AA books or whatever, and write in my journal, try to just kind of get myself oriented for the day. And I always write in my journal. When I close my journal, I always say, thy will be done at the end. Amen. My journals are kind of written to God. I write, you know, good morning, God. Thank you for this new day. And I just kind of go on and write about what I'm doing and maybe if something's bothering me. Let's see, step 12, working with others, practicing the principles in all our affairs. I am currently sponsoring 3 people. I have a sponsor. My sponsor's here. I believe in sponsorship, the importance of being honest with somebody else in the program about what's going on with me, about how I'm feeling. Nancy and I, we probably talk maybe every other week or so. We email and text and stuff like that. But it's just important, you know, to be in contact with other people. I have a lot of friends in the program, and you know, get together with friends for coffee, for lunch. I have friends outside the program, too. I'm going to talk to you about, I've got about, 5 more minutes? I'm going to talk to you about hope, experience, strength, and hope. I'm going to talk to you about what this program has done for me. I was painfully shy when I was a young person. And I think that was why alcohol was so wonderful, because it did for me what I could not do for myself. I never in a million years would have pictured my life as it is today. Because of AA and because I found clarity of mind, and discovered really who I am and what I love. And I let's see, it's almost been 20 years ago. I took a class. I was going back to school. I got my degree in sociology, but that's not what I ended up pursuing. I was taking an elective class. I took a class in ceramics. And who would have known that 20 years later I would be a pottery teacher at 2 different art centers. I make pottery. I have my own studio. I love that feel, that tangible feel of clay that you can just mold into things. And it's been, God, I can't even tell you how life-saving that has been for me to find my niche, you know, to find the thing that really grabs me. Other things I've done that I never in a million years thought I would do. I was in a bluegrass band for, I don't know, about 5 years. I took up mandolin. It just blows my mind, you know. I'm the shy person, you know, who could never, you know, singing in front of people, playing music in front of people, teaching, talking, you know. Today I taught a class all day. You know, if somebody would have told me this 20 years ago, I would have said, you are out of your mind. I would never in a million years have imagined it. But I also know, I cannot forget that if it wasn't for AA and my sobriety and my higher power, I would not have any of this. I don't even know if I would be alive, to be honest with you. So, so for me, I have to remember, always remember where this came from, this joy that I have, and any bit of serenity that I have, where this came from, and my sobriety, of course. I cannot forget, and the way I remember is by continually coming to AA. With, you know, 21 years of sobriety, some people might say, well, why do you need to go to so many of those meetings? For me, you know, I go to about 3 meetings a week, and that's a good number for me. More would be better. You know, more is always good, but 3 keeps me in a really good space. And so, you know, I go to meetings. I work with people. I have a sponsor. And every now and then I do things like this, which I really don't like to do, but every now and then I do them because I was asked to do it. I guess I think that's about all. So, thanks.
Thank you so much, Tammy. That was incredibly good for me to hear. Don't let her fool you. If you guys don't work during the day, the 9:30 meeting here at NAVA is incredible. It's a literature-based meeting. And Tammy chairs the Wednesday 12 and 12 study there. And she's an excellent teacher of that book. So, and it's a really, really good meeting, in my opinion.
While others live in high, a big piece of the pie, so many they got it wrong. As for me, when I want it too much, ain't never enough. Myself, hide it from everyone else, save it for a rainy day. If you wanna have it all the time, gotta give it away. All I had me love, kept it on. If you want love all the time, give it to someone else. I want everyone around to see how much your love means to me. Maybe wear it on my sleeve. It'll never leave if I give it and just.